Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com.
I'm Julia Tertian, host of Radio Cherry Bomb. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this half-hour journey, or trot, through culinary history. And I say trot because we're going to be talking about turkeys today. And we all know about the turkey trot, don't we? Well, we'll find out about it. Turkeys are very interesting. They are as much a cultural symbol. And, of course, at holiday season, we all fondly remember whether it's the Norman Rockwell-ingrained paintings of the turkey on the platter surrounded by the hungry onlookers of the family. But it is a symbol of family reunions and sort of always certainly the centerpiece of Thanksgiving or Christmas and or Christmas. And it's, as I said, as much a cultural symbol as well as it is a multi-billion dollars today. Who doesn't know the name Butterball? And let's go beyond Butterball. We certainly can. It is a bird, a dinner, a commodity, and a national icon. And the turkey has become as American as the bald eagle. And to talk about this terrific bird that is a new world food is Andrew Smith, who has written the book on turkey, by the way. But it was a while back, right? That was, we're talking
2006.
12, yeah, 2006. Not a new book, but he certainly did his research, so he can certainly talk about it. He wrote a book called Turkey, An American Story, the title of our show today. Andrew is a food historian who has been teaching at the New School since 1996 in New York City. He has written, I'm not even going to number.
We're at 26 now.
26.
Or edited, let's be
okay,
honest.
Written or edited over 26 books, including the Oxford Encyclopedia of Food and Drink in America. And he has written hundreds of articles in journals and whatnot, okay, and has been on different television shows about food and food history, and in fact, his most recent venture has been a consultant and on-air personality in a new series called
Eat, the Story of Food.
Boy,
National Geographic's that will air this Friday night, Saturday, okay. Sunday, which is November 22, 23.
Right, so depending on when you're listening to this show, check National Geographic. I'm sure it will replay on demand if you have one of those fancy TVs. But National Geographic, if you're hearing this live, it airs tomorrow, Friday, the 21st. 21st of November on National Geographic called Eat, the Story of Food. Very excited for this series, Andrew. Congratulations. And
It was fun. Yeah. It was fun putting it together.
I mean, as you say, it wasn't a textbook. It wasn't a classroom. But it's a fun, popular history. Right?
72 big names from chefs on the Food Network to Michael Pollan to even academics. They admitted to come in and do some interviews. So it's a really great diverse group of Americans that are interested in food.
Did you talk about turkey?
We did.
Oh, terrific.
How can you talk about food without talking about turkey? Let's talk turkey.
And there you go. That's something we'll talk about too, talking turkey. Well, I mean, it is, you know, it's this new American food, as I said. It's indigenous to the Americas. And yet, how did it land on the tables across the world? I mean, back up a little bit and talk a little bit about the wild where turkeys started.
Is this where I get to do my 3-hour lecture?
You do, All right. You do, and you do it well.
Actually, the turkey is an Asian bird, and it's very closely related to the Asian pheasant. In fact, you can interbreed American turkeys with Asian pheasants and have live progeny. So we do have turkey-like birds living in North America for the last several million years, but it is only in the last 50,000 years that the turkey that we know and love, we have archaeological evidence for. So the turkey was a very important bird in North America, and when people came into North America, it was certainly one of the most important foods that were served. It was domesticated in Mexico. The Spanish ran into it when they conquered Mexico. They introduced it first into they introduced the domesticated turkey first into the Caribbean and then from the Caribbean into Spain. And it quickly took off as a very important bird. And the reason is the male turkey spreads its feathers like the male peacock. And so the peacock was a very important bird in the Renaissance. And so the similarity. So almost immediately, the turkey was adopted in European cuisines, which is unlike so many other American foods that took hundreds of years before they were adopted.
Well, they would breed quickly and easily.
They bred quickly and easily, unlike peacocks, which were very difficult to raise, and very quickly they became an important part of European cuisine. In 1550, they are less expensive than chickens on the London market at Christmas time. And because they're larger than chickens, they obviously provide more meat. And,
well, that's just it. They're a big bird that could feed a lot of people and, you know, economical, right? I read when I was doing the research for the show, I did read your book, reread your book.
There'll be a quiz later on.
The explorers and people who came over were they demanded of them, England and other countries, to bring back equal numbers of male and female turkeys so they could start breeding them.
Absolutely. I mean, the Europeans looked at this and said, this is one of those great finds. Again, because it looked like the peacock. I mean, that's the strange part of the story. So it was very quickly, within a matter of 30 years from the time that it was discovered by Europeans, quote-unquote, it was a table part of European cuisine. And that's an incredible story.
And yet, you know, it's interesting because in a lot of, you mentioned the Renaissance, and in a lot of the table spreads and the beautiful displays, one sees stuffed peacocks and stuffed swans. I don't recall ever in any of the old books seeing a stuffed turkey, feathers and all.
Oh, I don't know about the turkey feathers. I mean, that was
feathers were used. I know feathers were valuable.
Feathers were used for a variety of purposes, but historically, it was the peacock with the male feathers. They would cook the peacock. They would remove obviously all the feathers first, and then they would take the peacock out of the oven. Then they would sew the peacock's feathers back on.
It's kind of disgusting.
Then they would walk out. I mean, well, food is a display.
And the swans, the same thing.
I mean, the peacock and swans were. I mean, part of eating is it's a performance, and it's not just, you know, gobbling up calories that so many of us think of food today.
Right.
So historically, that was it, and that was at least how the turkey fell into becoming an important part.
You mentioned that the Mexicans were the first to start domesticating these birds, but I mean they weren't domesticated as they didn't breed particular types, did they? I mean, what are we talking about here? How many breeds were there in the Southern Americas?
Well, this gets a little confusing because there were two different species of turkeys. One, the oscillated turkey, which does not cohabit the same territory as the turkey that we know and love. It is in southern Mexico and Central America, and that's the small area that it does. The turkey that we know and love actually had six different breeds that were common throughout from southern Canada all the way through Florida. So they were very common through and all the way down to Mexico. So they were relatively common, but they are different. You would not look look at a turkey today and think about what they would have looked like historically. Now, again, historically, the many of the turkey varieties were larger than the domesticated version at the time. You had 60-pound wild turkeys. We're talking serious turkey here.
I have seen some big ones up in the country, and I'll tell you about the damage one did to the side of my car. But that was a big bird. But, yeah, I was amazed at that. The domesticated birds were a lot smaller.
Well, initially they were smaller, and then obviously over 500 years they were bred larger, so that now...
Yes, you can have those butterball breasts.
Well, that's an interesting part of the story, too, in that for whatever reason, Americans in particular like white meat. And to me, I don't understand that because it doesn't have as much flavor as the dark meat does.
Right.
But the white meat came in for a lot of... simply because it added weight to it and you could make a little more money on it, but in addition to that, then you had this health-conscious America that comes along and said white meat has less fat and less calories, it has less taste, but that's not mentioned when they start advertising it. So,
well, it certainly was an interesting bird recipe-wise, too, throughout history. But as much as it was part of the Europeans' tables, there's really not that much evidence of it in writing until much later than what it first appeared on tables, from what I read, and I think some of it referenced in your book, but it was a long time ago, you probably don't remember. I think some of the earliest recipes were probably not until maybe the late 1500s, early 1600s.
Well, yeah,
Bartolomeo Scappi had recipes.
Turkey doesn't enter into Europe until 1520 at the earliest possible time, and there's no evidence for it for another decade or so. So you really have something that very quickly goes. It isn't something that's common for another 40 or 50 years from
that
point
on. Neither were written
cookbooks. And neither were cookbooks. Yeah. So people but they prepared it exactly the same way as they would have done a swan or they would have done a large goose. So in one sense, lots of the recipes are take the recipe for the goose and do the same thing for the turkey.
Yeah.
So so it's not extensive, but you certainly do have recipes in the 17th century that are common virtually in all European cookbooks.
Right, because there was some mention of Catherine de Medici hosting a banquet serving 70 turkeys, but yet a recipe in France, it seems, did not appear until the late 17th century, till La Varenne put something in writing, even though they were widely used, and even in the royal courts. But talk about recipes. A lot of, you said they did the same thing, but then there was a lot of experimentation with boiling them and
they tried everything.
Braising them.
Which was common. I mean, you tried everything with all of the birds that ended up on your table.
It's like, turkey again.
And again, we're not dealing with a modern oven, and so it's much easier to boil it. And the advantage of boiling a turkey, provided you got, remember the turkeys, domesticated turkeys are smaller than they're much smaller than they are today. The advantage was you ended up with a nice juice that you could make a soup out of, or you could make a stew out of, or you could add to a whole. You could use it as a gravy. I mean, you had 1,000 things that you could do. Not unlike what we do today.
Right.
So, yeah, what we do today is a little more technically sophisticated, but it produces the exact same types of dishes. Whether they taste the same or not is another issue, but they certainly are similar.
Pickled turkey. Now, that was something that was...
You don't like pickled turkey? Well, why not? You pickle everything else.
Know,
why can't you pickle turkey?
There's no room in the refrigerator. You might as well pickle it, right?
Well, the problem is you've got a big turkey, and if it's just the two of you sitting down and having some turkey, you're going to have a lot of turkey left over, and what do you do with that? And so they developed all sorts of different things that they could do in order to preserve it so it could be consumed at a future time. And people like the taste of pickled food. So it certainly is culturally a part of a number of culinary traditions. And
Well, the turkey itself has an interesting diet. It's pretty much an omnivore. Right?
It's an omnivore. It eats anything. And what's interesting about wild turkeys, if you go out and hunt them, they will they taste very different depending on what they've consumed. So they tend to eat, 70% of their diet tends to be vegetarian, whether roots and nuts and anything else
acorns,
that they get,
acorns,
anything, anything that they get their beaks around. And then the rest of it are insects.
Worms and snakes and bugs.
What's wrong with that? I mean, they provide a service. You know?
Well, part of their popularity in growing the flocks, too, when the colonies were established, you mentioned were the tobacco farms.
Absolutely, because they ate they ate what you think of as the tomato worm that goes on your tomato plants. Well, that's very closely related to the tobacco worm that goes on the tobacco plants. And so consequently, you put the turkeys out there, and the turkeys didn't like the tobacco leaves particularly, but they loved the worms.
That's
so
great.
You can just move your turkey herd right on through, and by the time they're finished, they're very happy, they're smiling, and they've gained a little weight in the process on it, and
yeah,
your tobacco is in
natural insecticide. Just bring in the turkeys, right? That's, I mean, what that, that's great. And in fact, I was learning a lot about turkey drives and netting
yes.
them that they didn't really, you know, like raise them so much as they just sort of kept them penned up and they would do their own thing. I mean,
yeah, how do you move? I mean, before you have trucks and refrigeration and things of that sort, how do you move turkeys from the farms, which would have been miles away from cities, into the cities? And much to my surprise, both in England and in the United States, you had turkey drives, some of which, by the way, went hundreds of miles.
Wow.
And the biggest turkey drive supposedly went 1,000 miles from Iowa to Denver. It was somebody who was taking his turkeys out there in order to breed them in Colorado, and the only way to do it is move it. But you get dogs, and the dogs keep the turkeys in line. The turkeys flock together. So as long as you keep the turkeys going in the right direction, the problem
and they
is,
don't really fly. I mean, that much they fly. I've watched them, the wild ones fly. They don't fly too far.
Turkeys can fly. I just want you to understand that wild turkeys can fly about a mile. They are not aerodynamic. They go in a straight line, and when they stop, they don't move anywhere for a long period of time while they recover. But they can fly, and of course, with domesticated turkeys, you clip their wings and make it so that they can't. And once you have breeding that produces much fatter turkeys, then those turkeys can't fly.
And of course, they can walk really fast.
They can trot very fast. Yeah,
but they're
a very inquisitive bird, and I'm sure that you've had exposure to them. But they'll come within 20 feet of you and just look and say, "What the heck are you doing?" You know.
And they usually run away pretty fast, but when we get out there, and then again, is there. We all know about the turkey, and of course, kids love drawing pictures of turkeys and the gobble underneath the wattle. Part of what gave it its name.
Yeah, we've got to have a turkey. So of course, that isn't the name in other European languages. In other European languages, the word is pavo in Spanish, for instance, which is the same word for peacock. I know that's a surprise. Mm. But when it came to England, how did the word turkey get there? And the answer is we don't know for sure. But
A lot of fairy tales out there.
Some claim it was turkey merchants from that engaged in trade with turkey, which I find hard to believe, but that's possible. There were other birds that were named turkey at the time, and this just fit in with that, and they moved right ahead.
Yeah.
But it makes a sound, too, and some people claim that it was the sound that the turkey made that got its name. I didn't quite hear that personally.
But the Italian I don't think they made the sound tacchino.
Each culinary culture introduced it into its own context, and where peacock was an important bird, that became the words that were used for describing the turkey. So,
yeah. I mean, the dates of the different explorers going back and forth busted the myth of a lot of, as you say, that, you know, the turkeys, birds coming from Turkey. Well, no one had come from Turkey. Or
there were turkey merchants.
Merchants or India, or when Columbus came back thinking he was going to India, right?
Oh, did he really? There's no evidence that he ever knew that. In all of the accounts, which are been greatly revised after his death, but there's no evidence that he actually knew he had arrived in a new world. So
yeah.
It's a fascinating story, and it's a great story.
I had a Mexican chef and historian on last month who said the turkeys, when they brought the turkeys back to Europe, they were so strange and foreign to them that anything foreign must have come from Turkey, so they would just give it the name Turkey. So there you go. It's another story.
It's so wonderful making up nice stories to try to say, why is it that this is the case? And the answer is, we don't know for sure.
Well, we're going to talk about some of the fancier recipes that we don't see too much today that were on the menus in the in Europe, particularly in the 1800s. After we take a short break.
Let's take a break.
Hold some suspense.
You are listening to Burgundy by The Hollows.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. In our industrial world, most wines have become brands, but the wines I love are so much more. Fine wine is a civilizing substance that connects us to nature. It cannot be stamped out in a factory. If you're listening to this great show, you probably eat different. I urge you to drink different too. Go deeper. Cane5.com.
Hey, my name is Betsy Andrews, executive editor of Savera Magazine, and I am hanging out at the coolest, most delicious place in the world, heritageradionetwork.org.
Okay, we're back talking turkey here, and that's kind of a funny phrase, too. We talked about the turkey trot, but turkeys sort of lent their name over the period of the several hundred years. First as an exalted kind of thing, well, we're going to talk turkey, which was a very honest talk, right?
Absolutely.
Frank talk. But then all of a sudden it got maligned, and someone who was a turkey was talking about it, didn't know what he was talking about.
But the turkey is such a funny-looking bird. I mean, it
It is.
It really is. And I'm sorry to defame turkey appearances, but, it really does lend itself to everybody knows what a turkey is, and everyone has seen one, and everyone looks at them and says, oh, that's really strange. And so consequently, that becomes very quickly a part of our common heritage of both fun and serious things about turkey.
And, yeah. How it can swing on both ends of the scale, though. It's amazing.
Ben Franklin did write a letter when he heard that the bald eagle had been selected as the symbol of America. He did write a letter saying, you really should have, that's the symbol of European nobility, the bald eagle, the eagle was. So what you really need is a symbol like the turkey, which is a real American bird. I don't think he was serious when he wrote the letter, but
I'm kind of glad that they stuck with.
Yeah, you know, right? I don't think that would have the same image on top of an American flag as an eagle would. Yeah.
Right, but we were talking about how it was an exalted dish sometimes to be on banquet tables.
Started to begin, yeah. Absolutely.
And stuffing turkey. I mean, there were some pretty fancy methods of preparing the stuffings, too.
By my count, there's at least, I ran into at least 1,000 different recipes for stuffing.
Wow. Know?
So it depended on whatever you had locally. So if you're in the United States and you've got cornbread in the South, well, then you stuff it with cornbread. And if you've got a lot of extra bread in the North, then you put it normal bread. And if you've got oysters and you're in the seacoast, then you stuff it full full of oysters. I mean, the real advantage of the turkey is there's a huge space,
yeah.
and you can put virtually anything in there. And a Renaissance dish, which ends up in New Orleans, and as the famed turducken is, you got a turkey, and you put in a chicken, and you put in a smaller bird inside that, and you have all deboned, and then you cut them up. I mean, that is a tradition that goes back 500 years. So lots of things that you can do, and of course, when the turkey was at its high point in terms of prestige, you would put a little truffles inside.
Little truffles.
We're talking serious.
We're talking lots of truffles.
Yeah. The American recipes that have truffles in them, I'm not sure that they're real truffles. I wonder whether they're just, you know, some other product that they call truffles. I never could figure that out, because it would seem to me that the cost of real truffles would have to have been imported from Europe, would have been beyond anybody's ability to pay for it.
I think there was some European presentation that was, I guess, must have made history of how many truffles were used in there. But then nuts, dates,
anything,
fruit, as you said, all kinds of the whatever.
Berries.
You
berries make a really delicious stuffing, so yeah. You can add all sorts.
Okay, so how did it boot out the goose on the English table for Christmas?
Well, the goose, of course, remained a part of English Christmas traditions, and as England did not celebrate Thanksgiving the same way that Americans celebrate mm-hmm. Thanksgiving, it was the big meal, and for the goose cost a lot more than the turkey did. And the turkey,
I mean, a Christmas goose was a prized dish.
Goose was and continues to be a prized dish in England, but the turkey is a great substitute. It costs much less, and it's voluminous, and you can feed a lot of people with it. And so the turkey in England is certainly a common Thanksgiving centerpiece, so that remains. In America, it gets more complex, because you serve a turkey at Thanksgiving, which, by the way, did not become universal until the late 19th century. It was certainly on the Thanksgiving menu, but there were a lot of other things on the Thanksgiving menu prior to that time. It will totally replace virtually everything else. So.
Well, we didn't even go there as far as talking about, you know, the first Thanksgiving. I mean, what? Everyone has these pilgrim notions and the first Thanksgiving and the turkey.
I love that story. It's a total myth. And we repeat it over and over again, and people don't really care about what really happened or what didn't happen.
No, it's a nice story, too.
It's a nice story. I learned it in grammar school, and I just want you to know, just before Thanksgiving, we always dressed up as pilgrims and Indians. I wanted to be the Indians, so because they had the bows and arrows, and I thought those were really cute to be able to hit a couple of people with the rubber tips on them. So
they were for the turkeys. Remember, those are for the turkeys.
What's a turkey? What's a turkey?
Yeah.
Well, but there's but really the turkey itself, it's inexpensive and it feeds a lot of people, and the Thanksgiving. What's impressive to me about Thanksgiving is it's the one real family holiday. It's not religious and it's not political, and it's the day that many families get together, that many other holidays that would not be the case.
And because it is so economical and feeds a lot of people, it ended up on as we said before, on the Christmas dinner table as well.
Well, but the problem is if you have turkey at Thanksgiving and you've got, a month later you've got Christmas and you still have leftover, it gets a bit much. So
indeed.
I think in America the Christmas turkey is less important than it is in England.
Well, we were talking about different menus and different recipes for preparing turkey. And interesting, I ran across this this group in the late 19th century. It was a Parisian group called the Constitutional Association.
Uh-huh.
And their mission was to promote good cooking. So they were really praising the braised turkey.
Oh. Braised turkey.
Which had been kind of talked about, but then maligned, said, no, one must roast it. But they tried braising it, but they really pushed for the braised turkey. And I have to say, it's interesting because in the 20th century, so it must have been around 1998 or so, Jacques Pepin and Julia Child
presented recipes for the braised
turkey. They were pushing braised turkey. I have to say, it's really, really good.
we all know how to follow Butterball directions to put our Christmas our Christmas or Thanksgiving turkey in the oven and do that. But sometimes you want some variety and diversity, and particularly for those of us who like to eat turkey year round. You don't just have to eat
relegated it to the holidays.
And
right.
So lots of ways of cooking it and preparing it. And personally, I absolutely love the deep fried turkey. It's a toughie to make, and it can be dangerous, but at the same time, it's absolutely delicious.
Better to have an outdoor space in one of those.
You need an outdoor space.
A special turkey fryer.
And
right.
Follow directions properly and have a fire extinguisher close by.
But it makes it fun. People do get to experiment. Now, I did mention that turkeys being a commodity and certainly a big business, in fact, a multi-billion dollar
business. Absolutely true.
And I didn't mean to malign Butterball turkeys. We all grew up with Butterball turkeys, and they were on every table. But what was happening is the turkey farms, as we know, some of them are just not that clean a practice. But we were also losing some of the heritage breeds.
Yes, the heritage breeds basically disappeared about 50 years ago when the broad-breasted white turkey became the dominant one from a commercial standpoint. And 99.9% of the turkeys that Americans consume are broad-breasted whites, which the Butterball is, and virtually all of the other commercial varieties that we find in our supermarkets. But what was really great is Slow Food came along about a decade ago.
And our own Patrick Martins.
And started preserving the heritage breeds, which were common in America, and farmers didn't mind raising them. But the question was, how could you raise them and still sell them? And they're not as big as Butterball turkeys, and they have lots of they taste differently, and so you've got to become more familiar with them, more easily. But I think that's a great tradition that it's now possible to, in order to save the heritage breeds, you need to eat them.
And they're becoming more affordable. It was expensive to buy a heritage turkey, heritage breed, because they obviously took more effort to.
And you can get them, and within a day or two, you can have them delivered in your home.
There you go.
Yeah.
So a lot of the breeds, the bourbon reds, what are some of the others?
There's literally hundreds of different historical breeds, but they're alive and well, and I think that's a wonderful story that hasn't been told and needs to be told more.
Yes, and I did have Patrick Martins on. He is the founder of Heritage Foods USA and of the Heritage Radio Network. And indeed, he introduced Slow Food to America, and he has done quite a job in supporting small farmers who are reviving these breeds. And we did talk about heritage breeds, often of turkeys.
And I wish him and the farmers all the best.
Right, because it is, as you say, it's very important, and it's interesting to taste. You're still not going to taste what a wild turkey tastes like. Wild turkey is. But a heritage breed will be interesting, not your Butterball, for sure, right? Well, as we are doing this show just prior to Thanksgiving, let's just give a little nod to the real story.
Oh, gosh.
I know we have talked about it in previous shows, and I think you've been on talking about it with me before. But, hey, it's a new audience today. Tell us a little bit about what really happened on that first, when it actually became officially Thanksgiving.
Well, the official Thanksgiving is not until 1863, and it's President Abraham Lincoln who declares it to be a holiday. He did so largely at the urging Sarah Josepha Hale, who happened to be a magazine editor, a New Englander who loved Thanksgiving and who wrote about it. And she, as far as I know, she was the first woman to write and publish a novel in the United States, which was a story about New England, and part of that was a whole chapter on what a New England Thanksgiving was all about. And she describes how they went for weeks in advance doing the preparation and then discussed each of the foods that were in there. But she fell in love with that, and she was the editor. She became the editor of Gottlieb's Book, which was by far the most important women's magazine,
one of the first cooking journal, cooking magazine. Well, or
it had food in it.
Home, shelter
but
magazines.
It was fashion. I mean, it was a whole series of other things. But it was, I'm sure it was probably the largest selling magazine in America at the same time, too. I mean, it was huge. And so she began her campaign in the 1840s trying to make each state declare the fourth Thursday and November as Thanksgiving Day, and she almost succeeded in 1859 when 30 states did so. But then the Civil War came along, and so she decided she's not really going to make much progress during the Civil War. So
The Southerners weren't too
keen
on Thanksgiving.
Overly excited about it for a whole series of reasons, even before the war. But she decides that we needed a holiday in the fall. Now, again, remember, there are only two national holidays in 1863. The first was, of course, the 4th of July, but the second was Washington's birthday, now kind of celebrated as President's Day.
A school holiday.
Whatever. It's a Monday in February, and that's it. But there was no national holiday in the fall. Christmas would not be declared a national holiday until 1870. So her attitude was you needed a holiday in the fall, and having this family holiday that was non-religious was something very important. So it is her effort to do that. No discussion of the Pilgrims, no discussion of the first Thanksgiving until after it's declared a national holiday. And then the Civil War happens, and you got a problem. You got all these immigrants coming in, and the question is, how can you tell them a story of America? How can you tell that America founding? And so
they are the story. But yes, no,
but that's an important part of the story. Right. But I mean, the Pilgrims in Plymouth were not the first European colony, and what's the day of the United States? Jamestown is the first English colony, and if any credit, it should have been to Jamestown. But Jamestown is a southern place, and so right after the Civil War, that's not in. Jamestown's where slavery began, that's not in. And the Pilgrims did have a nice dinner in the fall of 1661 with Native Americans. There were 50 Pilgrims. There were 90 Native Americans. And the Native Americans took a look at what the Pilgrims were eating and said, we'll go out and get you some food. And they went out and got some deer and may or may not have had turkey. Turkey would have certainly been available and they could have consumed it, but there's no evidence for it. So that event was not remembered. It was forgotten. It was not considered Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving was celebrated in the Puritan and separatist religions, but it was a day of church and it would not have been a day of doing frivolous activities like cooking and things like that.
Oh, well, I kind of like those hats with the big buckles and the shoes with the big buckles.
All
and,
mythical.
Right.
And those are images that were created on like Saturday Evening Post. Images that all of us think of and are so different than the reality of what the Pilgrims really like. And Plymouth Plantation is a great place to visit.
Does exist, at Plymouth Plantation. In fact, I had Sandy Oliver on a couple of years ago talking about the early Thanksgiving dinners.
I love Thanksgiving.
It's great.
Thanksgiving
is
my favorite holiday day itself and my favorite holiday meal. So.
Well, if you are hearing this in real time, we wish all of you a very happy Thanksgiving. And I'm sure there's going to be a stuffed turkey on your table. And I wish you good eating. And thank you, Andy Smith. As always, it's been a pleasure. Full of information. I need to get 10 more shows out of you, at least, by the end of the year.
I was hoping you'd ask.
And don't forget about the National Geographic Eat the Story of Food.
Tomorrow,
starting
November 21.
On November 21st on National Geographic Channel. And hopefully ever after we'll be able to source it somewhere, Netflix or something. But for now, it's all about radio. And thank you for listening. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio, and this has been A Taste of the Past.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
I'm listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.